really excited that we got her today, and she will talk about mass extinction and the new side of astronomy.
Connection points to astronomy. So I'm not an astronomer, so please forgive me if any of the details are a little bit different than how you're used to hearing about these things. But today, what I'll be talking about is just what extinctions are, the definition of extinction, the parameters of what makes an extinction, including like regular extinction versus mass extinction, minor extinctions. I'm going to talk a lot about the causes of extinction. Everybody, of course, knows about the cause attributed to an asteroid impact, but there have been many extinctions in the history of life on this planet and many different causes. So I'm going to go through the different types of causes and evaluate some of those. And then I'm going to take you on a very fast trip through the history of the Earth. I'll hit the highlights, including some of the major mass extinctions and what we know about them, and then wrap it up by talking about the sixth extinction. So that is what we have in store, and I'll be really curious to hear what kind of questions you have at the end. So when we're talking about what an extinction is, it really is very simple to begin with. It's whenever a species fails to reproduce the next generation, and then all the members of in that case, we're talking about like the extinction of a single species. A conservative estimate is that of everything that has ever lived on the Earth, 95% of it is extinct now. So what's living today that we see among us is like maybe 5% of what has ever lived on this planet. And so extinction is normal. It's like the natural fate of living things on this planet. We don't expect a species to persist throughout all of geologic time, because there is progress and change and speciation and so forth. So I found a Carl Sagan quote, I'm trying to connect to the astronomy thing. It says, extinction is the rule, survival is the exception. And that really it does encapsulate what we think about more extinction. So extinction is normal.
I'm audio recording it.
Normal state of living things. When we look at the fossil record, when species show up in the fossil record and how long they persist and when they disappear from the fossil record, the average is about 5 million years for that you can expect a species to persist. And some kinds of organisms are quicker than that. Their turnover is faster, like mammals. Others, like plants, sometimes persist much longer. And so it varies a little bit. And it's always a tantalizing question to ask, why does a species go extinct? And sometimes we can pinpoint it to a particular cause, but often we can't. And so we can have some hypotheses about why something might go extinct. And they might be very strong hypotheses, but it's really hard to know. There was a paleontologist in the 1980s, David Brown, who wrote a book called Extinctions, Bad Genes or Bad Luck. And that summarizes really well the kind of thinking about how we decide what causes extinctions, that sometimes we just don't know. It could just be bad luck. It could just be the circumstances of what that species was experiencing on the Earth at that time. So what about mass extinction? What constitutes mass extinction? A mass extinction is when many species go extinct within the same time frame. So typically the cutoff is that 75% of all the species on the planet go extinct. So that's the general threshold there. And so it's considered a kind of an event that takes place over a particular time frame, roughly 2 million years or less. 2 million years sounds like a long time, but in the span of geologic time, that's not that long. And some extinctions are faster than others. Some happen with like several events in a row, perhaps, but yeah, 2 million years or so. And you know, we classify it with that threshold of family, a class, even a phylum could also be extinct if all species within that phylum die out. So it's not uncommon in a mass extinction for us to also lose some of those bigger categories, those bigger branches of the tree of life during mass extinction, like, you know, the non-avian dinosaurs, for instance. So this graph here shows from the Cambrian, which is roughly 540 million years ago, to the present day. So this is the more recent part of our Earth history, our extinction rates. And what you'll notice here is that there's five peaks. And those five peaks are what we refer to as the big five mass extinctions. And I'm going to talk more about them a little bit later in the lecture, but I wanted to at least introduce them to you now because they are relevant to some of what I'm going to be talking about. So the first one in the Ordovician, 86% of species died. The late Devonian is actually a couple of extinctions mixed together, 75% of species. The End Permian, which is referred to sometimes as the Great Dying, 96% of all the species on the planet died. So that is the worst mass extinction that our planet has experienced. So we usually hear about the one that wipes out the dinosaurs, it's so famous, but this one is actually much more important to understand. And then there's the End Triassic, 80% of species, and then the End Cretaceous, which wiped out the dinosaurs, 76% of species. Just so you can kind of get a sense of like the scale, the scope of these particular events. But I'll go through like some of the causes of these in a little bit. So those are the big five. There's also 12 what we call major extinctions. So they aren't on the same level as those big five, but they are significant. They tend to be a little bit different in quality, not hitting that threshold of 75% species, or maybe they wipe out certain taxonomic groups and not others, so they're more selective. For instance, there were a couple of major extinctions in the Cambrian that decimated trilobites. Didn't really affect other things quite as much, but it was a significant effect that it shows up on here. So if you were to count all these arrows, you would see that there are 17 of them, the 12 major extinctions plus the big five. And so you can see that they're sprinkled through here. What's interesting to me is that if you just take those 17 and you isolate them and you stick them together, you may notice that it looks interesting, this kind of decline, with the exception of the one that killed the dinosaurs, it's kind of sticking out of this trend. And so this is a really interesting pattern. It might be just a bias, an artifact of our imperfect geologic record. It also could be real, that we have this decreasing intensity of extinction. If the pattern is real, the implications are important. And some of those implications might be that the animals and plants and living things today might be a little bit more resistant to extinction than they used to be back in the early part of the fossil record. Another one is that maybe the Earth is more stable for life over time. There's less disruption, less big swings of the climate, and so forth. A major kind of event is like big volcanoes could be maybe less common towards the present day. Or it could be some kind of bias. So it's a little unclear as to whether the pattern is real or not, but it's the kind of thing that generates hypotheses and examining these kinds of patterns with the fossil record. All right, so let's take a look now at some of the suggested causes of extinctions. What we know about mass extinctions and what we attribute the causes to be. It can lump them really into two categories, maybe two and a half. So one is terrestrial causes, things that are earthbound. One is extraterrestrial causes, things that are external to the Earth. And then the half is if you wanted to treat things that happen with humans as a little bit of a separate category. So I'm going to talk about more of these in the coming slides. But for the terrestrial causes, they span from bioevolutionary causes. That's like things having to do with the ecology biology of organisms, like what animals are doing, what plants are doing on the earth, and how it affects each other. Then there's climate changes, there are ocean chemistry changes, there's changes to the habitat availability, like oceans rising and falling, how much shallow ocean is there over time, for instance. And then volcanoes, which has a really large impact, as it turns out. And then for extraterrestrial causes, asteroids or comets hitting the Earth. And then there's some other kinds of interesting ones. You may notice I have question marks here, and I'll tell you more about why that is later, but solar irregularity has been proposed. So has things like gamma ray bursts or supernova. So there's some suggestion of that possibly being a cause, but I'll talk more about that in a moment. And then we do know that human beings do have an influence on living things on this planet, so that is also a suggested cause. So I want to talk a little bit more about each of these, just a few more details about them. So to speak to climate change, when we talk about climate change on the Earth and how it affects extinction, it goes both ways. We've seen the Earth get warmer, we've seen the Earth go cooler, and we've seen organisms impacted. And some of those kinds of changes has to do also with sea level rise. So when it gets colder, there's glaciers growing, sea level drops. When it gets warmer, you know, glaciers melt, sea level rises. And so some of these things are connected. So you'll have climate change that will then impact sea level and affect habitats. So we know that there have been mass extinctions. The Ordovician one tied to global cooling. The Permian one tied to global warming. So we know that there's good evidence for that being a driver of mass extinctions. Another one is a change to ocean chemistry. There have been times in our geologic past when the oceans went anoxic. They lost their oxygen. They got overloaded with nutrients, had gigantic algal blooms, and then the rocks that are from that time period are just loaded with carbon. And so there's these big shifts in the ocean that clearly have an impact on the survival of ocean-dwelling creatures. And then it also impacts the food chain on the land as well. And then flood basalt volcanism. There's a particular kind of volcano or volcanic eruption style called flood basalt. We don't have any flood basalt going on the Earth right now. We haven't for many millions of years. But in the geologic past, these were gigantic events, big fissures that would erupt for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, and spew out all of these gases into the atmosphere and influence our climate. So these are linked as well. So that's another driving force that we know is very closely correlated to mass extinction. And then as I've been referring to, the changes in sea level impact the habitat area for animals. So this particular image here is a reconstruction from the Middle Ordovician. This is what the Earth looked like when the limestone under Lexington and Cincinnati was forming. And so this is where North America was, like south of the equator, and most of it was covered with. So when sea level dropped, that ocean drained away, and the ocean-dwelling creatures there lost their habitat. So that's the kind of thinking here. So these are the very commonly referred to terrestrial causes of extinction. So for extraterrestrial, then, there's the very well-known asteroid impact. The kinds of effects that would happen from an asteroid impact, especially if it's dropped in the ocean, which it did in the Cretaceous extinction, a mega tsunami, dust in the atmosphere, perhaps some earthquakes, water vapor in the atmosphere, which has an impact on our climate, increased rainfall and mudslides, thermal radiation triggering wildfires, and there would be kind of a switch global cooling then to global warming. So you have this ultimate cause, this primary cause of an asteroid impact, then triggering climactic effects and other kinds of things that are more terrestrial in nature. So you have this kind of cascading sequence of hazards. Now, to speak specifically to the Cretaceous extinction, sometimes referred to the KT extinction or the KPG extinction, it's all the same thing. an amazing discovery. And there's other kinds of evidence as well. So there is an element on the periodic table, iridium, which is a relatively rare element on the Earth, but in higher concentrations in asteroids. And in the rock layers that date from the time of the collision, we have that iridium anomaly found in rocks all over the world. So that's one very clear signal, a way for us to test into time when the actual impact event happened. So that's one line of evidence. Some other geological lines of evidence are in the form of shocked quartz grains. These are grains of quartz that essentially fractured and then fused back together instantaneously in the impact event. And we found them in different places like in Montana. The only way you can really get this kind of thing is through extreme heat and pressure, through an asteroid impact. Or a nuclear bomb, but you know, dinosaurs didn't have those, so it was asteroid impact. And then along the same lines, there's these microspherules. They're little glass pieces of sediment, these little balls of glass. This amorphous kind of glass without any crystallization in there. And they were ejected in the asteroid impact as well. And they're found in that same horizon with the iridium, with the shock quartz grains, indicating this kind of impact event. So we have very clear evidence of the timing of this event by looking at these kinds of materials. This is really cool. So in 2016, there were some scientists who drilled into the crater to try to uncover like what we could learn from the geology of the layers within it. So they drilled about 829 meters down into the crater. And the kinds of things that they discovered was that the rocks were really porous, very fragmented, no surprise there, really. But what was a surprise is that at a certain depth, they encountered granite. And you can see that switch here from the kind of ocean floor rocks to this granite. It looks like a granite countertop, right? So it's this light-colored rock, lots of quartz with feldspar. This is the kind of rock that we refer to as like basement rock. It's deep down in the crust. You normally wouldn't see that up at the surface, especially not on the ocean floor. And so the hypothesis here is that in the immediate moments following the impact, the rock acted like a fluid. And the granite came up much closer to the surface to become a part of that crater structure, and then that was actually uncovered with this borehole. So I think that's a really neat discovery, just thinking about the kinds of conditions that would be required to turn the crust into a liquid, essentially. So that was within the peak ring of the impact crater, if anyone is knowledgeable about what impact. So what about those other extraterrestrial causes that I put question marks on before? Well, one that has been suggested is that perhaps solar irregularity, solar flares, it has some kind of impact on life on our planet. You know, we know that it impacts our electronics, our communications, when there's really active solar flares. I was reading about this as I put together this talk that there was a really active solar flare during the time we were using telegraphs that actually caused telegraphs to catch on fire. It was really interesting. I had no idea. But anyway, the sun has these 11-year solar cycles, and when there's more activity and less activity. So we really don't have any evidence that it influences the like survivability of living things on our planet. So while it's an interesting idea and certainly is worthy of like exploring and testing, we don't think that it is a strong candidate for causing extinction events. And then the other one that comes up a lot is the idea of gamma ray bursts being a cause of an extinction or a supernova event. This is where I had to look things up, and you probably know a lot more than I do about this, but you know, gamma ray bursts are essentially like supernova explosions. Sometimes it can be caused by neutron stars colliding together, and then it ejects out these really powerful rays of gamma radiation. And it collapses either into a neutron star or into a black hole. And it's very fast, so the amount of energy that's released from one of these things in the course of a minute is equal to like what's emitted from our sun over its entire lifetime. That's what I read on the internet. So you can correct me if I'm wrong. But the idea is that if it is directed towards the Earth, perhaps something like that could have an influence on life on our planet. The problem is that we don't have evidence for that. There's nothing in the rocks that we can detect that would suggest that something like this happened. Perhaps someday we'll have some technology to detect like the influence of radiation on the rocks and the sediment to know if something like that happened. But as of right now, we have no evidence that that would be a trigger for any of the extinctions that we've experienced. But if you watch like shows on the Discovery Channel or whatever about mass extinctions, it doesn't brought up a lot because it's sensational and interesting. It just doesn't have evidence. So I just wanted to throw that out there for the sake of being complete. So if we look at all of these different causes and the evidence that we have as it relates to the timing of mass extinctions, the dominant cause appears to be flood basalts, those big volcanoes. So just to compare it to asteroids, we know that there's been impact events on our planet many times. There are dozens of them, but most don't correlate to extinction events. So of the 17 major and mass extinctions, only one of them is correlated strongly to an asteroid and that species extinction that affected the dinosaurs. But for flood basalts, 91% of them correspond to a major extinction. There's a very close correlation between this particular kind for volcanic eruption and extinction. There is a flood basalt for all 10 major extinctions since the Permian. So since that part of the geologic record, it's a very close correlation. Before the Permian, there's more sketchy evidence, so it's a little bit harder to say. But there's a lot more of these flood basalts from the Permian on in the rock record. So another dominant cause is those bioevolutionary triggers, like what the animals are actually, and the plants and all the living things are actually doing on our planet to change it. Examples of what this looks like, organisms sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere, like taking it from CO2 and putting it into limestone. So you think about all the limestone that we have in Kentucky. That was formed by living things. And it's calcium carbonate. Formed from CO2 out of the air. Another example is like living things getting buried so that their organic material is actually being buried, so this is sequestering of carbon there. And that's what turns into coal and oil and natural gas. So the sequestering of carbon there, pulling it out of the atmosphere and burying it. So that's going to influence the climate. And then another one, plants colonizing the land. When plants first showed up, they started to form soil, and they started to put nutrients into the ground, which then washed into the ocean, and then loaded the oceans up with nutrients that they've never had before, and that changed the ocean chemistry. So that's another kind of interesting bioevolutionary cause. And then just interactions between organisms. When predators showed up for the first time, that changed things. That changed how organisms living, how successful they were at survival, and so those sorts of dynamics would play a role as well. Okay, so now I'm going to transition to the rapid fire trip through geologic time, where I'm going to put this stuff into context of like when the extinctions happen and what we suspect that actually triggered them. So to orient you, on every slide we have this timeline at the bottom. So over here is the origin of the Earth, 4.5, 4.6 billion years ago, and then moving towards the present day here. And as I move, there's an arrow that's going to follow along with the timeline so you can see where we are. So this is going to be very fast, 4.5 billion years in like 10 minutes. Okay, so we're going to start with the Hadean. This is when the Earth actually formed in the first place. So we're talking about these like rocky bodies in space, these planetesimals that are colliding together and creating together and forming this big ball of molten rock in space. So there was no atmosphere, there was no oceans, there was no layers inside the Earth, no magnetic field yet. It was just a big molten ball of magma. And then moving forward a bit, we have the formation of our moon. When an object, and hypothesis goes, an object the size of Mars collided with the Earth and spun off a chunk that then was trapped by our gravitational pull and became our moon. So that's a pretty big highlight in the history of the Earth. And then we're going to jump right into the start of the Archean now. So the Hadean that I just talked about, that's when the Earth was just that melted ball of rock. So life would not be possible there because it was over the boiling point of water. So by the time it cooled down enough for us to start to have an atmosphere coalescing around it and below the boiling point of water, that's when it's theoretically possible that life could start to get established. So that marks the start of Archean eon. And we have our definitive first fossils in the rock record at 3.5 billion years ago. It's possible, it's very likely, that life existed prior to that. There's chemical markers in the rocks that suggest that, but the definitive fossil that's like, oh yeah, that's a fossil, 3.5 billion years old, and it's a creature called a stromatolite. And so these are layered structures of bacteria, cyanobacteria, and they were very important because they are our first photosynthesizers. So prior to this point, no oxygen. These creatures are responsible for actually changing the atmosphere of our planet such that it has oxygen in the oceans, trapped in rocks, in the air, changing the Earth around. So at the end of the Archean, there's a kind of transition in our oxygen. So those stromatolites have been pumping out oxygen for a long time. So oxygen is in the oceans and binding to rocks and sediment there and creating what we call banded iron formations. And that's depicted up there. So it's like rusty rocks in the ocean. And then at this transition point between the Archean and the Proterozoic, there's a rise in oxygen that we see on the planet. It's called the Great Oxygenation Event. And it's when we start to see rocks on the land start to get rusty too. So it's as if the oceans are now more saturated with oxygen, and now the air is starting to rise in oxygen as well. It's rusting rocks on the land, so it's building up and building up and building up. So it's this continuous kind of transition to an oxygenated planet. And then much later in the Proterozoic, there are some interesting fossils. Now, there have actually been some other fossils that are suspected along the way. I just don't have time to talk and tell you about all of them. But there is this recent study from 2021 that I think is worth mentioning, where there's some suspected sponges, multicellularly, from about 890 million years ago. So it's a little bit sketchy. Like, when we have papers like this that make a claim to push back multicellular life by many millions of years, there's always a little bit of pushback because extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So I would say I would like to see some more studies, some more discoveries of fossils like these in the same time period to make me more confident that that actually is multicellular life represented and not just like some blobs in a rock. But it is a more convincing one than some other studies I've seen for early life. But the next study is very convincing. So these are multicellular embryos from the Doshantou Formation of China. And they date to 600 million years ago, which is more in the realm of where we start to see more fossils show up in the fossil record. But they're amazing. So these are like under a scanning electron microscope. And you can see like the blastocysts, like all the cells that are in these kind of interesting formations of like division and these kinds of spiral structures. So it's very interesting. Definitely multicellular. What they are, nobody knows. They're just these embryos that we have no idea what they belong to. Nothing in the rock record at this point has a shell, a bone, hard parts of any sort. It's all this like cellular stuff. So it's hard to know what this belongs to. But You never know what we're going to find as we continue to do this kind of work. So these were discovered in the late 1990s. Okay, so closer to the end of the Proterozoic, we start to see some really interesting fossils. We call them macrofossils, fossils you can see with the naked eye. And they are weird. So some of them look like quilted fractal pattern feathers. Some of them look like, blobby, wrinkled things. Some of them look like they have bilateral symmetry. And I use these terms because we really don't know what they form. Like, they don't resemble modern-day organisms in large measure. There's sometimes people try to fit them into a group. But what's interesting is that these Ediacaran fossils, they're named for the Ediacaran hills of Australia, but we see them in other places around the world. Like, they show up globally. There's some in Namibia, there's some in Nova Scotia, like, they're all over the place. And so it's clearly like a global fauna. And then they're gone. They just disappear. And so it's like life was experimenting and then poof, gone. But then we get to the start of the Anthropozoic eon. This is the time or era. This is the time that the fossil record is very full of fossils. So there's like creatures with shells and hard parts, so it's much more likely that they will become fossils. And so we have a much more complete picture of what life is doing at this point. And so this starts with a time that's often referred to as the Cambrian explosion. And it's just a figure of speech to say that like life exploded on the scene, because all of a sudden we see all these very fully formed fossils with shells and hard parts and eyes and all kinds of complexity. And it's a really fascinating kind of time. Some of the creatures, we can figure out what they are. So this bizarre thing, it's called Hallucigenia. Great name. but they figured it out that it is actually related to the modern-day velvet worm. So like some of them, they can look at the anatomy very carefully.
Modern-day what? Sorry.
Velvet worm. It's an onychophoran, and it's like its own weird group. But they live in like the rainforests of, I think, in New Zealand now. Anyway, they lived in the ocean back in Cambrian. But then there's other things, like this is Opabinia. It had five eyes and a grasping appendage with like a claw on the end, like lobes to swim. Was it a mollusk? Was it an arthropod? Was it some kind of shared ancestor, some stem group that's like separate from these? I don't know. And then this one, Muwaxia. It's often attributed to like an armored slug, but we really aren't sure. So it's still very speculative. Like, these things are just so bizarre. But with more and more studying, sometimes these sorts of things get untangled. As technology advances, like, we're able to do CT scans of fossils and look at things under scanning electron microscopes and so forth. Sometimes that gives us new perspective on these. So then we move into the Ordovician. This is the time period for, like, the Cincinnati area, which is, like, full of fossils. So if you ever get a chance to go fossil hunting up there, I recommend it. All of the fossils up at the top are from Cincinnati. So this is a time when everything is in the oceans. It's a very diverse time, and it also bears a lot of fossils that have connections to things that are alive today. Squid, clams, snails, arthropods, sea stars. That spectacular sea star fossil there. These are so old, 450 million years old. But just amazing. But then we get to our first of the big five mass extinctions, which is associated with global cooling. So remember, this is when there's sea creatures making limestone, pulling carbon dioxide out of the air, and causing our climate to go colder and colder. And then the secondary effect is that the sea level drops, drains off those shallow oceans where all those organisms were living. And so it's that combination of things. That's the leading ideas about what caused this particular extinction. Then we get into the Silurian and Devonian. These are the time periods that our rocks under Louisville are from. So there's the Louisville limestone that's Silurian in age, and the falls of the Ohio, which maybe some of you have been to, is Devonian in age. So this is a time of huge transition, the transition from oceans to the land. So there's still plenty of sea creatures in the oceans. There's fish, armored fish the size of buses that are big predators at this point. But there's also early amphibians making it onto land, and early land plants. So this is a time of transition. And then at the end of the Devonian, we have our second big mass extinction. This one is often attributed to that rise of land plants, the plants creating that soil, like I was telling you about before, the nutrients washing out into the oceans. You get these black shales all over the place towards the end of the Devonian, signaling that kind of anoxia event in the global oceans. And then right after that, we get into the Carboniferous. It's the time, if you're familiar with paleontology, with big giant insects, like the millipedes that are like 7 feet long and dragonflies the size of eagles. But it also is a time of tremendous plant growth. So those plants are pumping out oxygen. It makes it easier for those insects to get big. But it also is a time when a lot of carbon is being stored. So you have those plants in the coal swamps creating and burying that coal. So the coal in eastern and western Kentucky from the Carboniferous. And so that is the kind of dominant story there. Lots of plants also. And then we get to the third of the big five. So this is the Great Dying, the Permian extinction. And this one is associated with a gigantic flood basalt. So this is kind of that transition to where we start to see the flood basalts be important. So the flood basalts in this case were erupting in what we now call Siberia. Siberian traps is what they're called. And it was causing global climate fluctuations and caused the oceans to actually release a lot of methane, which then caused additional warming. And so it created a lot of instability. And there's also evidence of ocean anoxia here, too. So there's like multiple layers of disruptions to the environment happening here. And then after that, we enter into the time frame of the dinosaurs, the Mesozoic era, and the Triassic period. So we had dinosaurs, yes. We also have our fourth of the big five mass extinctions. This one also associated with a flood basalt. And this is when Pangaea was rifting apart. So that big supercontinent that formed over the Earth at that point was rifting apart all over the place. So lots of volcanic activity with those flood basalts. And so extinction here. Following that, heyday of the dinosaurs, the Jurassic. My student's favorite because they can remember it. But at this time, you know, dinosaurs are diversifying. We have our first birds. We have the famous transition fossil of Archaeopteryx between dinosaurs and then the avian dinosaurs and birds. So it is like an interesting time. No major extinctions here. But then we get into the Cretaceous, which I've talked about already with you today, the asteroid impact. There were flood basalts as well. You may be familiar that there was a lot of feuding between certain paleontologists about the cause of this extinction. That there's a couple of outspoken paleontologists who attribute it to the flood basalt, but the overwhelming majority of scientists are convinced by the evidence for the asteroid impact as the causal mechanism for this extinction. And a lot of it has to do with the timing. The timing of the extinction coincides much better with the timing of the evidence for the impact rather than the volcano. So you can look into it more. It's an interesting story of just like how science works, of how these scientists are like kind of feuding over trying to figure out the cause. The only other thing I'll add to the Cretaceous here is that throughout the whole time of the dinosaurs, mammals were there. They weren't doing much, but they were there. And we also have this advent of flowering plants showing up in the Cretaceous. So there's some things that we have today that were in place in the Cretaceous. And then when the extinction happened and wiped out the dinosaurs, what made it through then proliferated. And so in the Cenozoic, which is the era that we're in now, the wild and wonderful world of mammals and all kinds of weird mammals like the egg-laying platypuses and all of the cetaceans like the whales and dolphins. All of these crazy mammals started from very generic-looking ones that looked like little dogs or shrews at the time of the beginning of the Cretaceous, and then diversified in all these different directions. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention also the Ice Age extinction, which a lot of people are familiar with. This is not a mass extinction. It's not even a major extinction. This is a minor extinction. Like, it's notable. We notice that many creatures die, but it's particular ones. We refer to them as the Ice Age megafauna, the really big mammoths. And it's very clear that it is connected to the actual people. By this point, we're at like almost the present day when people are there and we have evidence of overhunting. Now, if you look at megafauna globally, you can see like the timing of when people showed up and then extinction happened. People showed up and then extinction happened. And so this graph here shows that relationship. So for Africa and Eurasia, people and the megafauna were already coexisting. So the impact of extinction by humans is not as great because they already were like co-evolved, coexisting together. But once people showed up to North America, 50 out of 60 megafauna extinct. South America, 34 extinct, 13 remain. Australia, 14 extinct, 2 remain. The two are the emu and the red kangaroo. But it's very convincing that there is this kind of causal mechanism of humans showing up and just killing these large megafauna. So that's called the overkill hypothesis. So then that brings us to the very end of the timeline here today, the time of people. For a long time, the people who are in charge of the geologic timescale were debating, you know, are we going to adopt the new time period that's called the Anthropocene for this time of man? And they just recently rejected that. If you follow the scientific news, they decided, no, we're not going to add a new time period for that. But even so, there's no denying that humans have played a huge role in shaping our planet today. You can't look out of the window of an airplane and not see like agriculture or infrastructure of some point, some kind like affecting our planet, whether it's urbanization or what have you. So when you think about this big sweep of time that we just went through in a short lecture today, like all of the things that have happened on this planet, and then you get to today and you think about what humans are doing, I think it's kind of sobering because now we're in this time that people talk about called the sixth extinction. And so the idea is that we're in a time of elevated extinction. That's not that normal background extinction that we expect to happen, but like above that rate. And so there are things like human-induced climate change, habitat loss, introduction of invasive species, and overexploitation in general that's going to be affecting ecosystems. And so it's sometimes hard to get a precise kind of idea of exactly what the extinction rates are because we haven't studied it. So, like, this chart here shows major groups of organisms, and the gray bar, it's unknown, because we haven't studied all the mammals. We haven't studied hardly any of the insects. But what we have studied, some of them are stable in their population, some of them are growing, but a lot of them are decreasing. So we do know some things, that there are certain groups, like birds, amphibians, that tend to be more sensitive, but there's still a lot that we don't know. So there's a lot more work to be done to catalog the species on our planet and understand their population growth and decline. And then we can also look at this one. This is showing rates of extinction over time from 1500 to this stuff in 2018 in different groups of organisms. And then that down here is like the expected extinction rate. And so they're exceeding the expected extinction rate by quite a bit. Amphibians, very sensitive, mammals, birds, reptiles, and fish. So in any case, it is hard to quantify this, but it is clear that we are having an impact on the natural world. So I'll stop there and take any questions that you might have. The book depository and all that. My students don't get that joke. Yeah, so the last ones that have happened on the planet were up in the Columbia River Plateau of, like, Oregon and Washington State. They're, like, 5 million years ago, which really isn't that long ago, to be honest. The things that cause those are, like, hot spots underneath the continent. So think about, like, Yellowstone as an example of, like, where there's a hot spot there. But it's where it is under Yellowstone is not triggering that type of eruptions. I think it's just a matter of, like, geological happenstance of where you have hot spots underneath continents in the right spot for causing that kind of fissure. So the configuration of our continents right now is not causing flood zones. Yeah?
Obviously, you're focused on big extinctions, right? So at the beginning, you talked about the 95% of the species died out. I wonder how many of those 95, do we know how many of those 95% died actually on these big events versus on the normal rate?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, of like what proportion of the 95 that have lived and died died during mass extinctions versus background. I don't know the answer to that. What I could say is that those mass extinctions have the possibility of wiping out really big groups of organisms, like the phylum level kind of stuff, and like really pruning that tree of life in a sense. Like the background radiation will take out a species here, a species there, but those mass extinctions have the possibility of taking out entire groups of organisms and opening up ecosystems. So like think about the dinosaurs dying, making room for the mammals. So those mass extinctions have a way of like kind of resetting the ecological playing field for evolution then take its course after that. So that's what's kind of different about that pattern.
It also seems like it's a different mechanism, right? If there's a whole branch of living beings disappearing, they're not evolving into something.
Yeah,
why did one species go then maybe we simply evolved into something? Or would you not call this an extinction?
So like if one species dies,
evolves in something different.
Right.
Evolves in the dog and then a wolf, and you know,
right.
An extinction of the
wolf. No, so if it's one thing actually evolving into what we would recognize as a different species, that's we would refer to as anagenesis. It's like a particular kind of speciation where it's like you would recognize certain qualities and then, you know, millions of years later it's not recognizable as the same species. So there's like different mechanisms for speciation. Sometimes it causes a truncation, sometimes it just changes. Yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned at the beginning that the average extinction is 2 billion.
So, well, that a mass extinction could take place over the course of 2 million years.
2 million years is such a long time frame that evolution actually would be a viable way of getting rid of a whole species, right?
Well, so this is
how would you identify that in your records as being extinct due to just getting lost or being moving away from future?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So there's this concept in evolutionary biology of gradualism, which is like gradual change, and then punctuated equilibrium, which is like episodic change, and it's often related to perturbations of the environment, like a volcano, or like these extinction events, like something major that's like causing strife and difficulty for these organisms. They have to adapt and die. And so there's like bursts of a lot of adaptation and change during those episodes of the punctuated equilibrium model. And then there's times of state, what we call stasis and gradualism, when there's not a lot of chaos in the environment and there's slow kinds of change. So we would recognize that in the fossil record by examining how the fossils change over the course of time. Doing this is what I'm thinking about, successive layers of life, right? And so, you know, there's a friend of mine who works at the Cincinnati Museum. She's an invertebrate paleontologist like me, and she specializes in trilobites. And she goes out and samples trilobites from very specific layers, layer by layer by layer, and examines how their eye shape changes. And so there's things like that where you're looking at very painstaking detail. detailed changes and trying to get a sense of how fast it changes, how much they add segments to their body, or like the head shape changes. And so for an invertebrate paleontologist like me, like that's our bread and butter because we have a lot of fossils to work with. A dinosaur paleontologist has a few bones, right? Maybe a specimen here, a specimen there, but an invertebrate paleontologist, we have thousands of fossils and we can actually chart those very, very detailed changes, especially in a place like Cincinnati that has like spectacular layers of rock full of fossils.
Back to the question about floating salt. Based on your answer, it sounds like maybe sometime in the future we'll have a lot more. And they were responsible for a lot of extension. One more question. The crater in Yucatan, how do you pronounce it?
That's how I pronounce it. It's probably not accurate. That's how the scientists say it. I bet if I was Mexican, I'd have a very particular way of saying it.
The Snowball Earth. I understand the whole bird is covered with ice. Do the oceans themselves freeze all the way down, or is it more like just a layer of ice on top of the ocean with liquid water?
Yeah, so the Snowball Earth, just to put this into context, that happened before the Cambrian. So it was, I think it was even before like those weird quilted looking fossils. But my understanding of it is it's sort of like the surface was frozen, but not the ocean all the way down. So I think of it almost like a little bump in a sense, like that outer like outer layer of ice with the ocean underneath. That's my understanding. I've never heard anybody say anything about this being completely solidly frozen oceans. Yeah, I don't think that would be hard to do.
Could you imply that the sequestration of organic carbon as coal and oil triggered a protection sequestration of atmospheric carbon?
So the sequestration of the carbon into fossil fuels is it relates to some climate changes in the Carboniferous, but not an extinction. So there was cooling at that time, and there was more sequestration, like a lot of oil formation in the Cretaceous. But like neither of those were, in my understanding, correlated to a mass extinction. But it does have a regulation kind of effect on our climate, like causing some cooling when the carbon is being sequestered. The Ordovician extinction, it does seem to have something to do with sequestering carbon, but in the form of limestone. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So you kind of mentioned when there's those moments of like those big mass extinctions, you'll see quick changes, like big differences happening quickly. I was just curious what the biggest organism example that you know of that had those big changes that we can still like it. It was a previous example, but they have some really fast big changes.
Oh, okay.
Like, or are they all very small, you know, what we think of as quickly evolving organisms that make these quick big changes, or some larger organisms?
I have to think about that one. If I could think of, like, a particular organism that adapted well.
And made a
big leap.
Big leap, in quotes.
I mean, when I think about survival tactics for extinctions, a lot of it has to... Like, I work with invertebrates in the ocean, so some of the creatures that tend to escape harm find refugia, like they find places to go to kind of weather the storm. Like, they might have a shift in their preferred habitat, so they might go from shallow water to deep water, and so there might be some adaptations in terms of, like, their lifespan, like, they might live really long. They might be able to live, like, without the presence of sunlight, like in the deeper ocean. But I don't know, I'd have to think about that in terms of like big evolutionary leaps of a particular group. I mean, there's always the kind of speculation about like, well, why did creatures go from the oceans to the land? Like what kind of pushed them in that direction? And so that kind of stuff happened in the Devonian, like when the oceans were getting those nutrients for the land. And so there's hypotheses that some of those creatures were making it out to land because there was food. You know, there was plants to eat. There were insects and things to eat on the land. But there were also escaping predators that were those big fish the size of buses. So there's, like, those sorts of adaptations. That might be probably one of the biggest transitions, is, like, making it from the oceans to the land.
During the Cambrian explosion, was there really enough time for all those different species to evolve? I mean,
no.
That doesn't seem right.
No. So I think, like, it looks sudden, right? But I think that many of them were there in some form, but they didn't have a lot of hard parts. And so there was this kind of, there's this thinking that something in the water chemistry changed, that organisms started to secrete shells to, like, excrete some of that buildup of calcium carbonate that was in the ocean. So, like, they were metabolizing this stuff in the oceans, excreting it, and then developing hard parts, which then became fossilized. Prior to that, they were soft and squishy and didn't fossilize very well. So it's as if there's this, looks very sudden, but it's that there's this transition where now we're seeing many more fossils. So it maybe is somewhat of an artifact of, like, how fossils form, that all of a sudden we're able to see it because they're preserved more readily. And we just don't have, like, a clear picture of that, of what happened to lead up to that point, because it's such a rare thing to fossilize something that's so squishy. Like, a worm doesn't fossilize well. A jellyfish doesn't fossilize well. It's rare, and it does happen sometimes. But then once they have, like, scales, shells, you'll start to see it more. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to what you was talking about with carbon sequestration in the Upper Paleozoic. If you look at the Devonian, you look toward the end of the Devonian, you have a major anoxic event. You've got through all of these shows.
That's
right.
Marcellus
shale,
yep.
All the way through eastern Ohio, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. New York. These are black shales. Oxygen depletion.
Yeah.
Big time.
Yeah.
And consequent loss of various species of planktonic organisms in the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then we enter the Carboniferous. Vascular plants really started to take off in the Devonian, but in the Carboniferous, I mean, it was
yeah.
nature.
Yeah.
Right. So you've got all your lithopods, your tracheopods, all of that, giant club mosses,
yep.
tree ferns, giant horsetails. At the end of that, there's a massive die-off that you didn't mention, really. It's called the Carboniferous rainforest collapse.
Okay.
And so many of those species, if you were a paleobotanist, it would definitely count for you,
mm-hmm.
it's a mass extinction. And then when we get into the Permian, as soon as we go into the Permian, things warm up. We got oxygen-rich rocks, all the Permian red beds and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, granted, there are changes with paleogeography. Pangaea is being put together
mm-hmm.
at that time, and it's pretty much a single continent by the time we get into the Permian. But there's some major tipping points that have gone on with regard to CO2, O2 ratios in the atmosphere, vice versa, in different directions, over that period from the close of the Devonian to the beginning of the Permian. I just wonder what your thoughts are with that.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, you know, there was the Carboniferous is well known for that rise of the oxygen. And I know a little bit about, like, the changing of the faunas, the floras, and the warming of, and the drying of the continents in the Permian. Like, the Permian, with that formation of Pangaea, you have this big continent, and the interior essentially becomes like a desert. And so the floras are starting to change, too. And you get things like cycads and some of those plants that start to become more important in the time of the dinosaurs. So there is a transition there, but that's kind of the limit of my knowledge in that realm, because I mostly work with, like, the aquatic, like marine fossils. So I don't know if I could add much more to what you were saying. Yeah.
So assuming that we kill ourselves off, global warming or whatever, what do you envision being the historical view of humans influence on the climate?
I ask my students that question, like, what's our fossil record going to look like? And I have a couple of colleagues who wrote a paper about this, actually, of just, like, what would our fossil record look like? So one of the things that they wrote in that paper is the legacy of, like, industrial farm complexes, just, like, the sheer number of livestock that we have put on this planet and, like, their remains that end up, like, changing our world. So that's one aspect that they brought up in their paper anyway. Concrete, metal, all of that infrastructure that's sort of like geologic materials. I mean, they're man-made, but they're durable and could fossilize. Like, we could have this layer of this, like, urbanite, we sometimes call it, right? And then plastics, if they hang around long enough, like, to have some signature of humanity in that respect. So, you know, if we're really thinking, like, post-apocalyptic humans not being here, like, there would be that kind of layer of infrastructure that would be, like, this, like, geological time signature of us. That's what I commonly read about when that question comes up.
When will that happen? Do I need to worry about
that? I wish I knew the answer to that. I mean, the reality is we're running an experiment with the Earth in time frames that are much faster than anything that I talked about here. So, you know, we can learn things about how our climate reacts to different stimulus by studying the fossil record and, like, the isotopic signatures of this and that, but nothing is as fast as what we're seeing now. The closest analog is an event called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum that happened about 50 million years ago. It was like this burp of, I don't know, methane or something that caused our climate to heat up really fast and then drew down really fast. And so there's a lot of people that are interested in studying that as, like, some kind of an analog for understanding what's happening today. But I don't know. I mean, we are amazing in one respect because we have the ability to design our manufacture our world in a sense. But one thing I've been thinking about a lot lately, I've been reading about human population growth lately. I don't know if any of you have too. It's been in the news and how we're set to peak like 2060, 2080, and we're not going to level off. We're going to. And I didn't really realize how fast our humanity's population size will go back down and what that means for, like, our own ability to adapt to economic changes and the ability to continue to, I don't know, invent things and advance knowledge when we have a much smaller population. So these are the kinds of things that I like to think about. You know, I think about long time spans going back to the origin of the Earth, but I also think long-term of what the future looks like, too. It's like, there's actually a term called, like, long-termism that explores that idea of, like, the choices that we make today and how it will affect things, not 100 years from now, not 1,000 years from now, but 100,000 years, a million years. So I think it's an interesting thought experiment. Yeah.
What do you think of Lovelock's ideas about